sit right back, then you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip.
In the year 1831, biologist Charles Darwin began a fateful journey on the HMS Beagle. On that journey, Darwin formulated the controversial theory of evolution, which has impacted society down to this day.
Our goal is to punch holes in that theory, so we'd like to welcome you to
Sink the Beagle.
Fire one, Captain.
Good shot, John.
Thanks for letting me use the control stance. I love to put torpedoes into that boat.
Well, you're doing fine. My name is Stan Hudson.
And I'm John Kurlinski, and we'd like to welcome you to another fun-filled episode of
Sink the Beagle, which is a lighthearted look at the heavier issues of creationism and evolutionism, where we came from.
Where we're going, maybe even eventually, looked at from a not-so-heavy-handed or heavy-hearted way. Hopefully we have a little fun, too.
It's the only way we know how to talk about things anyway. Okay, we're going to talk today about what?
About dates.
Dates.
Don't
oh,
you
goody.
Love going on dates?
Yes, where's my son and daughter? They need to hear this.
Well, not those kind of dates.
No
Dad.
Kind of dates. What kind of dates?
Well, actually, we're going to talk about dates of how old things are.
How old things are. I think you're pretty qualified to speak on that.
Yeah, you're even more qualified.
Okay.
Anyway, the first, you know, actually, we want to begin with a torpedo text today because for a creationist, how does creationists get their dates? Well, they go to the Bible.
They do. We do.
We do. Not all creationists do, but we do. And we begin in places like Genesis chapter 5, where it says these words in verse 4, "And the days of Adam after he became a father of Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters, and so all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died." And then it would say, "And Seth lived 105 years, became the father of Enosh, and Seth lived 807 years after he became the father of Enosh. He had other sons and daughters, so all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died," and so forth and so
and
on.
So forth.
And so creationists have taken the addition and subtraction.
Got the calculator out, added all those texts and those numbers up, and what do they come up with?
And when you add those up in the post-flood numbers, you come up with an Earth that's somewhere, give or take, a couple hundred years, around 6,000 years old.
6,000 years old, with the pre-flood years being about 16 and a half centuries, about 23 and a half centuries before Jesus, and about 20 cents. Yep, that's 6,000 years.
Yeah, well, what the question we have, though, Stan, is that we can date the Bible, those things, that way, but scientists date our Earth differently. They say it's billions of years old. Where do they go to find the dates for billions of years?
Well, you know, you think about it, thousands and billions, there's a little difference there.
Just a few.
Just a few. And frankly, this is an area where creationists and evolutionists often have perhaps the real biggest fights and struggles over trying to find common ground. Now, what we're going to talk about today is radiometric dating. Radiometric dating is the way that evolutionists and scientists rely on dating the age of rocks.
Rocks? What kind of rocks?
Well, not all rocks, because frankly, most rocks are not dateable.
They're not like they're sedimentary rocks. Would I want to go date a piece of sandstone? Could
I date
it?
They have terrible personalities, and no one's going to date them.
Oh, man.
Sorry about that. Okay, three out of four rocks are sedimentary rocks.
Which means that they are formed by sediment. In other words, lots and lots of water.
Lots of water. Isn't
that interesting? Sounds like a flood to me.
Flood, yes. That very difficult word for long-agers to speak. But anyway, back to rocks, what kind we can date. Three out of four are sedimentary, and because they're made up of little grains of different kinds of rocks from different places and then re-cemented into something, it's hard to figure out how old that rock is. But the ones that come out of the earth as molten rock and then cool and harden, those are igneous rocks, and about one out of four rocks are igneous rocks. Those they can date using the radiometric method.
Okay, and how many different radiometric methods are there?
Well, there's probably several dozen. There may be more than that. Probably the most commonly used ones are called potassium-argon dating, followed by maybe uranium-lead dating, and there are several others. But potassium-argon is far and away the most commonly used, probably used 80% of the time or more.
Now, if we want to go and take a rock on a date, or better yet, date a rock.
Date a rock, okay.
We'd rather do that instead.
I dated rocks. Go ahead.
I tell you, we want to go with that one too far.
No, we don't. Go ahead.
Where do you begin? Do you go to where, the birth date of the rock? Is that when the lava or whatever, the molten material, came off the earth and just hardened? Or
kind of back when the volcano sort of went, you know, and then out this rock kind of blob fell and hardened, and that was a
birth date. Well, spank it awake, and here we go.
There was a baby was born. And that, and the reason that they use that is the beginning date is because that's when it had the original material in it, and it was before it started to decay. Immediately after it was formed, it starts to decay.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's we all kind of decay, don't
too much,
we?
Too much sugar, maybe.
Maybe.
Cavities,
yeah,
you know?
Kind of, yeah, exactly right.
So anyway, so the scientists take the rock. Uh-huh. They take this new rock.
Yes.
And they, well, if you're an eyewitness, you don't need to even take it anywhere. You know the date of that rock. It should
eyewitnesses are always the best way to tell us how old something is, which has a Genesis kind of ring to it.
Well,
but anyway.
You and I were at Yellowstone a few years back, Stan, and we were listening to a real neat lady. She's a geologist named Elaine Kennedy.
Yes.
And she was sharing with us that they know that in Hawaii, mm-hmm. there was a recordable date for a certain rock.
Yeah.
It was a volcano that when it erupted, and they know the flow occurred in 1801.
Right, a couple hundred years ago, right.
And then she told us that when they did some tests on that on those rocks, they decided to date those rocks.
Okay.
Those rocks came back 1.1 million years old.
Yeah, just a little different.
They should have been like 150 or 200 years old at the
time. Give or take, yeah.
Give or take. Mm-hmm. You know, what's this? Where did they get this 1.1 million?
Well, you almost never hear about the problems they have in radiometric dating. And yet, if you talk to the people involved with the scientific discipline itself, they will admit that there are lots of inconsistencies and problems. In fact, it's not unusual to date a single flow from a volcano and get different dates going down the flow from that one volcano. So lots of problems. But, you know, there are three assumptions that all radiometric scientists use to base their thinking as to why you can date a rock using radiometric dating.
And those assumptions, I guess, are the key to understanding whether or not we want to even look at radiometric dating as really valid dating.
Right, exactly. And it does have a basis in science, a basis as fact, but let's hear those three assumptions.
Well, the first assumption that I've understood is that they know the original proportions of what we call parent-daughter material.
Parent-daughter material is simply this. The parent material is the stuff that came out of the volcano originally. It's sort of the original stuff before it began to decay. And the daughter material is the decayed stuff. And as a good parent, you know that all children are not as good, not made as good as stuff as the parents were.
It's a decay thing. Yeah, as a parent, we know that.
Right.
But the question is this. What we're saying then is that science is assuming then, if I'm not mistaken, that all the stuff, all the lava underneath is basically the same. There's not different concentrations.
Right. Exactly.
Well, that's not like me and my pancake batter, Stan.
It's not like you and your pancake batter. How do you mean that?
Well, if when I make pancakes, sometimes I don't mix it quite good enough, and I'll be putting the pancake batter onto the old griddle, and there'll be a little puff of flour. Like if I'm comparing potassium and argon, like I'm comparing ingredients in a pancake batter, this is a way of analogy.
Yeah.
It seems like that to assume that all of it's just a pure smooth thing.
Unlumpy.
Coming out of a real rough-going earth that's supposedly been cooling,
churning,
shifting, molding, and churning, is potassium lighter or heavier than argon?
Well, potassium argon is the potassium is a solid and argon is a gas, and so that's one of the reasons why they rely on this method, because they assume that when the rock becomes hardened, the lava becomes hard, that by that time all the argon, the gas that's in it, is kind of, you know, gassed away, puffed away in the bubble, you know, away and given off. And so what's left is the potassium. But as the potassium breaks down over time, it becomes, breaks down into a little bit of argon that's sealed in the rock because the rock's hard now. Can't get out, away.
Mm-hmm.
And then they cut it open and they find it and they measure it. So much argon per potassium. But here's the thing. Like you said, they're assuming that the material that came out was consistent. The proportions were consistent. That's the number one assumption, that the daughter parent ratio is always the same.
And can they prove it?
Probably not.
And so we don't know. Okay, well, let's go to assumption number two.
Okay.
I was told that they know how fast the decay occurs and it hasn't been affected by other factors.
Right. The second assumption is that the decay that happens from parent to daughter is consistent. It never changes. There's nothing that can change it. And it is just as sure a thing as the clock ticks on the wall.
What if it happened underwater? Is decay the same underwater, under pressured water? Say if you have a lava seep in the bottom of the ocean?
Yes.
Are those rocks that decay and they have the same ratios as those above in the air?
You know, I'm not a scientist, but my understanding thinking is that these things are impervious to those systems being challenging or changing it. But, you know, there's still some evidence and maybe there are some possibilities in changing the rate. But that's a second assumption. Then there's a third assumption.
What's the third assumption, Stan?
The third assumption is that it's a closed system. That is that when you do these dates, measure the parent and daughter, that nothing has gotten in extra from outside that sample of parent or daughter to mix up the numbers. There's nothing that's
ever... No one slipped in a little extra potassium or something.
Kind of juiced it with a little bit, whatever, you know. No, it's pretty well supposed to have been the same closed system. So those are the three assumptions. Now, are those assumptions for sure right, or are there ever any exceptions? Do we know of any cases or any comments from geochronologists or anything?
Well, I understand that... on one flow on just in the mountains in Hawaii, the volcanic mountain in Hawaii, there was like four or five different dates out of the same flow in different spots.
Yeah, and that doesn't jive, does it?
Something isn't working there.
You know, on the subject of one of those assumptions about a closed system, that there's never any contamination that takes place, Elaine Kennedy shared with us. Yes, it was Elaine Kennedy shared with us that one geochronologist told her on the side, and I think this had to do with lead, uranium lead dating, that he does believe, and this is a long age evolutionist, this is not a short age creationist.
Yeah, she was telling us about that.
That there was some isotopes that did move. He thought that uranium and lead did move within the rock. And if that did happen, you got to throw out the usefulness of that measurement.
Even one assumption alone would make a methodology somewhat suspicious, but if you find two or three things wrong with that methodology, you'd kind of say maybe we can't even trust it as a way of dating. Hey, can you date, say, something organic? Let's say, you know, if you have fossilized bones, would you use potassium, strontium? What do you use to date something organic?
When you date something organic, you always use carbon-14. Everybody's heard of carbon-14.
Okay.
It's probably the most thought of answer to the question, have you ever heard of it? Yeah, carbon-14. Carbon-14 happens when nitrogen-14 in the atmosphere, I guess, bombarded with rays, becomes carbon-14. The carbon-14 somehow gets into living material like plants,
balls of the earth,
plants and so forth. Animals eat the plants, or it gets into animals, and then animals eat animals, but whatever. It gets into all living animals, and that prospect or procedure keeps going as long as they keep intaking stuff. When they stop intaking carbon-14, i.e., die, then the carbon-14 becomes eventually carbon-12. They have no more carbon-14 coming into their tissues, and so that ratio is also able to be determined, you know, carbon-14 and carbon-12, and they'll know how long it was since they died.
I understand that actually it was probably carbon-14 dating that really has launched a lot of the radiometric dating ideas.
Yes.
And it's fairly reliable up until about 5,000 years?
Yeah, 4,000 or 5,000 years, and it has to do with your understanding of the way the atmosphere is. If you get back to the Bible flood, the atmosphere changed at the flood. It's actually pretty accurate back to about those days. Then the dates start to go all over the place. It's kind of interesting that it's accurate about back to the 4,000 or 5,000 years ago.
They trust it to about that far, and they don't really date too much beyond that.
Yeah, kind of coincidental, I assume.
Hmm. Well, Stan, when we look at things, we look at dates and dating, I think that one of the things that we often think of is that, is it possible as well for God to create things with, I'd call, apparent age?
Good question. Now, did Adam have a belly button?
I don't know. Did the early trees of the Garden of Eden have tree rings?
Ooh, did the horses have long teeth?
I don't know, Stan.
Obviously, God created a garden that was ready for man to inhabit. He had trees that were bearing fruit, and it had a parent age. Adam and Eve had a parent age. They weren't kids. So, well, you know, the question is this. Did God create the mineral world like he did the animal and vegetable world with a parent age, with different proportions of things to be useful to man? It's a good question.
It's one that we'll have to investigate again in another fun-filled...
We don't have another amount of time. We got to end this.
Another week we'll check out another investigate another episode of Sink the Beagle.
Thanks for listening to Sink the Beagle. If you have comments, questions, or requests for Dr. John or Dr. Stan, you can email them at hudaho@mindspring.com. That's Hudaho, H-U-D-A-H-O, @mindspring.com. Be sure to listen in next time to Sink the Beagle.
So join us here each week, my friends. You're sure to get a smile.
from seven stranded castaways here on Gilligan's Island.